Good morning. It is 8:06 on this Thursday, August 21st. I'm Christine Weller, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on the local news hour. It is 58 degrees Fahrenheit right now in Park City. The high today is 88 degrees. Over in Heber, it's 59 degrees at the moment. The high there is 93 degrees. And we'll turn it over to ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes for a more in-depth weather update.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Thursday, we are tracking changes across the area. You probably noticed a few more scattered clouds out there in the sky today. We're also going to have a chance of a couple of isolated passing showers. Not looking at a ton of rainfall today, but there could be a passing shower or two moving through. Highs in Park City will only be into the upper 80s today with those extra clouds in the sky. The Heber Valley, we're still looking at those temperatures climbing into the mid-90s. And again, there is that chance of that passing shower as well in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Friday, look for partly cloudy skies. Temperatures will start off in the 50s and low 60s. As we go into the afternoon hours, look for highs in the upper 80s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low, maybe still touching the mid-90s in the Heber Valley. Now, you're going to notice a slightly higher chance of a few isolated showers and storms as we go into your Friday. And speaking of higher chances, that will be the trend as we go into the upcoming weekend. We're looking at more clouds than sunshine. And yes, a very decent chance of scattered showers and storms. In fact, I think we'll call it scattered showers and storms in Park City in the Heber Valley as we go into your Saturday. But I'm liking we're going to see more scattered to widespread showers and storms as we get into your Sunday. High temperatures on Saturday in Park City will be in the upper 80s to near 90, with highs in the low 90s for us in the Heber Valley. By the time we get towards your Sunday, due to the extra chance of rain out there, highs will only be in the low 80s in Park City, with highs in the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. As we head into next week, yeah, we're looking at a much more active and wetter pattern that will continue to kind of build in across the area. So high temperatures, look at this in Park City for your Monday, only in the upper 70s, only in the low to mid 80s on your Monday for the Heber Valley, and showers and thunderstorms will be likely. Showers and thunderstorms remain likely as we go into your Tuesday. Highs in Park City only in the mid 70s, with highs only near 80 as we get into your Tuesday. And by Wednesday, highs will only be around 70 in Park City, with only in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley, with another good chance of showers and thunderstorms. So a wetter and cooler pattern on the way. As we look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back, I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Now we've got Mountain Trails Foundation Executive Director Laura Anthony on the phone with this week's Trails Report. How are you doing?
Good morning. Happy Thursday, Park City. We have got quite a lot going on the trails, and I guess that's just because we've got events all over the place that we're getting rain this weekend. Hallelujah. So let's start off the top. We've got Mid-Mountain Trailhead will be closed for construction, scheduled to conclude construction in October. They'll be doing a bunch of improvements, and that trailhead will be out of commission. So the Mid-Mountain Trailhead is no-go for the next month and a half or so. Take transit up to the Montage. You can take the purple bus from the transit center, or you can take on the weekends the transit to trails and get up into the Bonanza Flat area on Fridays through Sundays. Looks like Basin Rec is reporting that they've got art on trails in McLeod Creek, and we have a volunteer dig day on Mid Mountain to 9K hiking trail on Saturday, 8:30 to noon. You can find the details on the Mountain Trails Facebook page, or you can email ian@mountaintrails.org if you'd like to sign up. We've got Quinn's Junction impacted by the Summit Challenge. The National Ability Center's big bike ride of the year is going to be this Saturday, so it will be impacting the Quinn's Junction parking area and the National Ability Center area trails. This is not on the dirt, but let's see. Upper Sparrow, Rick is reporting we've got Upper Sparrow above Ham is closed for a splice on the Quicksilver Haul Rope. It should be reopened on Monday or Tuesday. And Ian is reporting that we've got 70 spots left for the Tour de Suds, the annual Tour de Suds, 41st annual Tour de Suds. If you want to sign up, you better do it soon because we're about to sell out. Looks like Mia from Wasatch Trails Foundation is reporting that the Deer Valley East Trails are still closed for snowmaking infrastructure, and I think that wraps it up. It's going to be a busy weekend out there. Enjoy the cooler weather, and we'll hope for some rain. We'll see you out there.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Bye.
That was Mountain Trails Foundation Executive Director Laura Anthony. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Christine Weller filling in for Leslie Thatcher. Coming up on the show this morning, Summit County Councilmember Candace Hart recaps Wednesday's meeting, including the vote to repeal the First Dakota Pacific Development Agreement. Then Park City School District Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman and Board of Education President Meredith Reed discuss the start of school and early learning goals. And Arts Council of Park City and Summit County Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder and Jacob Crane from Cultural Fire Events have details on Saturday's Art on the Trails. After that, stay tuned for Cool Science Radio at 9 o'clock. Climate activist and author Bill McKibben explains why the rise of solar and wind power may be our best and last chance to slow global warming and how communities around the world are leading the way. Then Pearl Sandick, interim dean of the University of Utah's College of Science and a professor of physics and astronomy, will talk about the new Crocker Science Complex. It's a $97 million project that blends cutting-edge research facilities with historic architecture to transform science education and research on campus. All that coming up this morning. Summit County Sheriff Frank Smith says he's stepping down next month. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on what's next.
Summit County Council Chair Tanya Hansen read the sheriff's resignation letter at the Wednesday council meeting. He'll step down September 5th and has endorsed second-in-command Chief Deputy Casey Bates as his replacement. Smith has served as sheriff in Summit County since June 2023 when then-Sheriff Justin Martinez was tapped as U.S. Marshal for Utah. He had been Sheriff Martinez's chief deputy and was subsequently elected in 2024 after running unopposed. According to County Attorney Margaret Olson, Chief Deputy Bates will temporarily serve as acting sheriff after Smith retires. Whoever is chosen as his official replacement will serve out the rest of his term expiring at the end of 2026. The county council must notify the Summit County Democratic Party of the vacancy because Smith is a Democrat. The party will have 30 days to nominate a replacement, and the council will have a week to confirm them. Bates is also a Democrat and serves as the party's North Summit vice chair. This is a developing story. For more information, visit kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
On the phone with us is Summit County Council Member Candace Hart. He's here to recap Wednesday's meeting, including the vote to repeal the First Dakota Pacific Development Agreement. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
So the council considered repealing its original development agreement with Dakota Pacific, or at least the ordinance approving it yesterday, but you voted 4-1 not to do so. The decision is closely related to the ongoing court case over a referendum challenging that development agreement. Can you explain that discussion yesterday?
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of a unique one. Certainly not your normal set of circumstances. There's an ordinance 987. That's the one that was voted on back in December that had the development agreement that people refer to as Dakota Pacific. And Dakota Pacific has withdrawn the application. So that application no longer exists, meaning that the ordinance essentially is just kind of floating out in air. It's not applied to anything. So from a house cleaning perspective, you should just kind of clean it up and get rid of it. Although, as we all know, with the referendum, and there's a dispute over whether the signatures should be counted or not based on the binding, that would go between the courts. What you could hear the council discussing and really trying to figure out was, you know, one argument would be like if the, let's say the signatures get counted, it rules in that favor, and then it's put on the November ballot, and then, you know, it goes to the people, and then they vote to repeal the ordinance. That's essentially what we were being asked to do last night, was to do the, what would be the final result of a referendum we could have done last night. But well, there's a number of people that are interested in seeing how the courts rule on the bindings, hoping that it'll provide clarity. Because certainly, like for all of us, as a citizen myself, I like the idea of a referendum, or I certainly want the right to a referendum. And the state does not make it easy on us. And if we basically erred on the side of the people in that if we think the courts might clarify this or provide some clarity, it could be worth letting it go through. Although, and for anyone listening, in truth, we're not even sure the court's going to hear it. I mean, what was presented to us was that since the application is already withdrawn, that it's very likely, seemingly almost assured, that the courts won't even actually hear the case because it's moot. It doesn't apply to anything. But we don't know that, and we didn't want to be the ones to make that call, so we thought we'd let the court make that decision. And in the end, we chose not to repeal the ordinance.
Okay, and there was also discussion about not wanting to waste taxpayer money. How much money is being spent to litigate the referendum signature issue, and how much more will it be to wait?
That's a good question. It's one I certainly was focused on, and I asked there was 2 points really to sort of drill in on that one. One, the county is the defendant. So as far as to spend the money or not spend the money, the person who's brought the suit ultimately triggers that. That was the county attorney's statement, which was, we're not in control of whether we have to defend ourselves or not, or the clerk's office has to defend itself. But I was trying to get a sense of, well, how much money are we talking about here? Because one perspective would be like, look, since this ordinance applies to nothing, the application's already been pulled, you know, other than the symbolic nature of trying to go through the courts, it gains nothing in the end. And in the end, it just repeals this ordinance, which won't have any effect on whether something's built or not out at Kimball Junction. And so it's sort of like, well, how much money is everybody spending, like, on both sides? You know, just as a human, you kind of, you know, people are spending money. It sounds like most of the money has been spent. What the county attorney said was that amount of money would be de minimis because they spent most of their time was spent on the briefs preparing for court, and with court, and they're prepared now. So it sounded like, in the grand scheme of things, it was not going to be that much, but they didn't give us a dollar amount.
Okay. And why do you think Dakota Pacific withdrew its original application now?
Well, I mean, it's exactly what we said would happen back in December when we voted for this application, or for the ordinance in the first place. The state was always, we always knew that, we didn't know it would be called Senate Bill 26, but we always knew that the state had this legislation ready to go. And we had learned about a year and a half before, when the ruling for Hideout through the Supreme Court said that the county did not have standing, it fundamentally changed the complexity of the case. And keep in mind, the county was using our inside lawyers, but we also had outside legal counsel. So the council figured, you know, the best way to, if you'd let something like Senate Bill 26 or whatever it would have been called just happen on its own, and there's no agreed development agreement, then they could build anything they want. And so it was better to work on an agreement together so that hopefully we can lock that down. And we told everybody, I mean, I literally said it on December 18th that this would happen. And, you know, so they filed the referendum, Senate Bill 26 gets passed. So here we are now with that. And so for Dakota Pacific, they would have gone with the original agreed amended development agreement if it was faster for them to build something. But once the referendum was filed and it's going through the courts, and they already had Senate Bill 26 in their pocket, they just pivoted. So now they've filed that application through Senate Bill 26, which takes the power away from the county, and it's already been processed. So they don't need to have this application out there any longer. It's moot to them as well. So they withdrew this application, which, like I said, makes our ordinance 987 attached to nothing, and they will go ahead and build their project under Senate Bill 26.
Okay, if the referendum is moot and the application is withdrawn, why does it matter if the old ordinance is still in the books or not?
Well, it matters in that if, let's say, you leave it in there and the referendum, if the referendum did not exist and you have this ordinance 987, it wouldn't really affect anybody. You wouldn't notice that it's technically on the books or not, right? Because nobody would be interacting with it. It would just sort of be out there, and you'd probably clean it up, and, you know, a council would repeal it, and nobody would think twice of it. But because there is a referendum and there is a focus on it, and the referendum technically, as much as it's spiritually a movement against the Dakota Pacific, and, you know, I think it's the people expressing our desire to say we want control, local land use control, technically, it's the referendums to repeal this ordinance. So that's why the only reason it matters is because there is a referendum, and people are very concerned about whether their signatures counted or not based on, you know, two different interpretations of the law. And so that's it. Otherwise, it has no real effect on anything we do. If we left it in, doesn't change anything. If we take it out, it doesn't change anything. We just thought we'd let the courts rule so that people can get clarity on the bindings.
Okay. Let's move on to some sustainable code amendments. The council passed code changes in the Snyderville Basin requiring bike parking and car charging infrastructure in all new developments. This has come back to the council multiple times. Why all the additional discussion?
Well, there was things that seem simple sometimes when you get into an ordinance because it applies broadly across a larger area. Can have some ramifications that you don't always foresee. So you're kind of always digging in and trying to imagine what those scenarios are. And one of them was, as an example, the idea of it doesn't have to have the car charger installed, but it has to be, a building has to be prepared to allow for a car charger. So essentially running the cables so that they're in the garage or in the location where a charger would go. Well, you know, if you want affordable housing, you want to try to keep the cost of the housing down. So as much as you may want them to have the ability to have electric car charging, if you force it on them and then it drives the price up in any way, because it's just many things together could make something more expensive, you could have an unintended consequence there. So like as an example, one of the carve-outs that was in last night is that the Basin Planning Commission, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, will review it on a case-by-case basis. And if they, you know, want, they can give someone the option not to have the car chargers installed if it's an affordable housing project. So that actually took a few meetings, you know, of discussion before things like that came forward. And so those are the kinds of things that were cleaned up. And then last night was largely us just seeing something we'd seen before and agreeing that the changes we'd asked for had been made.
Okay. Would those code changes impact either Klein Dolly or Dakota Pacific, since those will be governed by development agreements, or would those not be impacted?
I take it this with a grain of salt. My understanding would be, since there is a development agreement or an application for any project, in this case, like I think the Dakota Pacific one, I don't believe it would apply, although it's in their plans to do that anyways. Something new, if it even comes to fruition, like in Klein Dolly, it would apply to it because there is no development agreement. There is no, signed agreement in place already.
Okay. And will Eastern Summit County get similar code changes at some point?
Yeah. It's interesting that, largely our code is the same east and west, but there are areas where it's different, obviously based on more of an agricultural area on the east and then more densely populated on the west. So we have obviously some things that are unique to both sides. But generally speaking, we try to bring parity in and have something be on both sides of the county if it makes sense.
Okay, and then as far as the council did approve on the east side the agricultural tourism rules, there's a new conditional use permit that property owners can apply for. What would that allow?
This one, it's coming back, actually. I don't think we actually approved it there, or did we? I could be misremembering. But this basically is, we're trying to define how big or small and what's the easier process for a person to go through. Because they can get a conditional use permit, why have this other zone? But we're trying to encourage what would be considered agricultural tourism, whether it's ranching or farming or whatever that land use is, could be guided tours on horseback, things of that nature. And so that's essentially what we're trying to do, is give clarity. So if somebody is interested in providing that service or that type of business, this would be the path for them to do that.
Okay, and the new cidery in Marion is something staff said would fit under that conditional use permit. But if the cidery could already get up and running, why is there a need for a new CUP for similar businesses?
I think they're obviously just using them as an example. They won't need to do that. But if something like that was coming before us today, they would use this zone, or they could. They would have a couple options. And in their case specifically, they're already approved, so it doesn't really apply to them.
Okay, that makes sense. Finally, Council Chair Tanya Hansen kicked off council comments by pushing back against rumors that the county is moving the county seat and services from Colville to Kimball Junction with the purchase of the Skullcandy building. I was wondering if you could address those rumors.
Yeah, sure. I honestly have no idea where they came from. The only place I've ever even heard it or seen it was the chair of the Republican Party, and his op-ed in the Park Record has quite a few false statements in there. And one of them is that there's a vindictive council that will move the the seat of to the Centerville Basin. I've never heard that before. I've certainly never heard a council member utter it. So I can tell you categorically, it's just people starting rumors and just trying to start something where there isn't anything. The county seat is in Colville. That's where it stays. The building, Skull Candy Building, actually was an incredible purchase. You know, we are building a new building right now for the Justice Center over at the courthouse and the sheriff's office. It's a very nice building, but it's more or less just imagine a rectangular, two-story rectangular building. And the cost on that in today's dollars is $25 million. So we were able to buy the Skull Candy Building for $17.5 million. But in addition to the building, we bought the property that goes up towards Tech Park Drive. So we got additional property, which lowered the density on the Dakota Pacific project. But it allows us to take all the services out of the Richens building. That's the stuff that's going to move, like where the library is. And what a lot of people don't realize is like where the DMV and that lower level of the Richens building, there's actually tons of offices in the back. And we got people literally working in closets and you know, stuffed in all corners. So we'll put the library goes in. I think it's on the west end of the building on the ground floor. DMV is kind of in the middle. There's going to be a new community space on the east end. And then the second floor, I don't think's determined. I've heard, I just don't want to say what the rumors are because there's staff, there's actual real people that might start wondering if they're moving over there. But it'd be more like basin-oriented operational jobs that would be housed over there if there are any.
Okay, that's all I've got. Is there anything else you think we should know?
No, but I just wanted to say thanks and thank you to all the people for all your engagement in all these issues. And always just email, you can go to the county website and it has the link there so you can email the entire county council. Usually the chair is the one who replies, but we do read all the emails. So really appreciate that. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, have a great day.
In the studio with us, we've got Park City School District Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman and Board of Education President Meredith Reed. We're here to talk about school starting this week and the board meeting that was on Tuesday. How are you guys?
Good.
Good. Good morning.
Good morning.
So just to start off, we've had the first few days of school happen. How have they been?
Yeah, it's been great to welcome all of our students back. Realignment is officially completed, so we have 9 through 12 at the high school and 6 through 8 at Ecker Hill and our four elementary schools, and it's been great to be in our buildings. Lots of positive energy and a fresh start to the school year.
And I know that the high school now has one lunch, so some students are dealing with that. We talked about a little bit at the board meeting. How's that been?
Yeah, so we made a decision to go to one lunch, 40 minutes. And really, that allows students to be with their friend group. What we had found historically, having two lunches, kids were changing classes to be with their friends, which I can't blame them. And now with the expanded common space, we can now accommodate one lunch.
Great. We also have talked about before, but just to kind of talk about it once again, 6th through 12th graders are going to have to lock their phones in pouches soon. You've mentioned that there's going to be some kind of education going on for the first bit of school. What's that been looking like so far?
Yeah, so at the high school, they had their class assembly, so freshman, sophomore, junior, senior class, setting the expectation for the school year. They explained what the Yonder system would look like. So students arrive on campus, they lock their phones during first period, they remain locked until fourth period or when they exit campus, whether that be for lunch if they're upperclassmen or say they have a parent release fourth period.
Okay. And I have a ninth grader who went through this last year at Treasure when we piloted the program, and there's certainly, you know, some grumbling about actually having to do this, but we do believe that this is the best thing for our students. It helps keep them focused. It gives them opportunities to engage with each other and keeps the distractions and bullying down.
And so your student then has dealt with this before. Is that, have they gotten used to it, or what's kind of the thought there?
Reluctantly. Yeah, she certainly, I mean, because we put it out in Treasure last year, and so she's very familiar with it, but, you know, there's always going to be a little...
With any new implementation, there's growing pains, right? And that's why we didn't do it day one. We wanted to educate our students about the why, because the why is important, and then just give them opportunity to ease into it. We want them to be present. We want them to connect with their peers. And ultimately, they are there to learn and engage with one another as well as their teachers.
Great. At the board meeting, there was a mandatory presentation on Title IX and athletics. Just kind of comparing the numbers with male sports and female sports. I'm wondering if you could do a little recap on what those numbers were.
Yeah, female participation rates are strong, but continued focus is needed to ensure balance with male athletics. Improvements have been made in areas to locker rooms, facilities, and scheduling. Very much you can see that work happening on Kearns Boulevard with the Treasure Mountain Sports Complex. And the report also stressed the importance of providing equitable access, not just in numbers, but the quality of the experience for student athletes.
Okay, that makes sense. And I know that the report also listed salary numbers and things like that. I was curious if there is any standardization for what coaches are paid for the same sport, or if that's just kind of how that works.
We talked about this in the board meeting as well, and it really comes down to experience levels. So there's not just a flat rate pay for a track coach or a cheer coach, but how long they've been doing it. So that really impacts what the salaries are for those coaches.
Awesome. Lindsay, you also talked about the district's convocation to kind of welcome staff back to school. And you mentioned that it was a really positive experience. So I'm just wondering if you kind of recap what that is and kind of what the vibe was.
Yeah, so convocation occurred on August 12th in Eccles, and it's really a welcome back for our employees. This year's convocation was about setting the tone. We kept it short, fun, and inspiring. It was more of a pep rally than an actual meeting. Post-convocation, we sent out a survey to get feedback. It was very short, so we received over 200 responses to that survey, and the message was clear that they felt their time was valued, because historically convocation has been multiple hours of them receiving training, being spoken at. And as a former classroom teacher, all you want to do is be in your classroom getting ready for students. So they felt that our leadership team really valued their time. We set clear expectations, and they felt that the district is moving in the right direction. Okay. We also introduced a new theme for 25-26, One Park City, where learning is personal and every path is possible. And that's what we want all of our students and our staff members to feel when they walk through our doors.
It seems like there's a big emphasis on having all of staff feel connected. I know you mentioned when Treasure Mountain, since Treasure Mountain has closed and those teachers were kind of split up between Ecker Hill and Park City High, that there might have been some sad feelings because they're kind of separated from their family. So I'm wondering if you'd talk a little bit more about that effort just to connect all of the staff.
Yeah, so this year we're really focused on culture, building trust, and just maintaining positive energy. So at every school, they're getting a culture budget to bring those staffs together, whether that be just simply providing a meal or doing some team building. As a part of that, every school had a rebranding of their logo, and that's also a way to bring staffs together that historically haven't been in the same building.
Okay. And Meredith, I also wanted to mention the board was really excited about AP scores. Tell us a little
bit
about that.
What was not to be excited about? It was phenomenal. We don't get our AP scores until the summertime, so that's why we were looking back at the last academic year, because kids take those at the end of the year. And we have phenomenal success for our students in the high school. I'm looking for the statistic. We have a ton of participation. I'm sorry, I don't have the direct number in front of me. Like a vast majority of our students take the AP test.
Mm-hmm. 700 plus kids are participating in.
And they have all passed those tests. We are expanding that access to try to encourage other students to participate in taking AP classes. And we are far exceeding other high schools and our performance in the AP. So.
Typically, when you see more students participate in an AP exam, you're going to expect to see your pass rate drop. That was not the case here in Park City, and we're incredibly proud of our students' AP performance. They're showing they can compete at the highest level nationally. You likely saw that many of our pass rates were higher than the state as well mm-hmm. as across the nation. And these results demonstrate not only the talent and dedication of our students, but also the commitment of our teachers who prepare them for success in some of the most rigorous courses.
And I know that Park City has a really wide range of AP courses, so it is kind of impressive to have so many high pass rates with that many courses. I think there are over 20 AP courses.
There is. There's 20 plus AP courses. They start in ninth grade and continue on up through 12th grade.
Yeah, so definitely good work for the seniors last year and other students, I know. Like you said, it's all
Yeah, we have freshmen who take the AP language exams. We also have AP Human Geo as a ninth grade class. So yeah, we have students across our grades who are taking those exams and doing very well. So we're super proud.
I also wanted to talk a little bit about training for administrators, deans, and directors. There are a few new administrators this year. We've got new Park City High principal, new Ecker Hill principal, and assistant principals. And you mentioned, Lindsay, you mentioned in the past that you wanted to have training for all administrators, even though typically it might just be for the new people. So I'm wondering what that kind of looked like this year.
Yeah, so we brought them together at the Pendry. We wanted to go off-site to build relationships and establish the expectation for the school year. We're thankful to the Pendry for sponsoring the space and the lunch. But it's important to build leadership capacity, especially when you have some that are brand new to assistant principal positions, as well as brand new to Park City. So we're really focusing on building relationships, because if you have those relationships, you can have those difficult conversations, and really impressing upon our administrators to have those conversations face-to-face. Email is for information, not communication. So when you're exchanging multiple emails, it's time to bring that individual in and have a conversation.
Yeah, that makes sense. I also want to touch on early learning goals. That was kind of a long conversation at the board meeting Tuesday. One of the big focuses this year is with math goals for first and third graders. It's a state mandated thing, and I'm wondering if you can just kind of recap what those goals are and why the district sets them.
Yeah, we want to invest in early learning because we know it sets the tone and the stage for everything that follows. The research is clear: when children have access to high quality early learning instruction, they arrive at kindergarten ready to learn, and those benefits last well until their school years and beyond. So this is just isn't a program or a goal. It's really a long-term investment in the success of our students in the community.
Okay, and part of it also was with literacy, reading comprehension, which the district has kind of had a focus on for the past few years. It was discussed at the board meeting that the program that was implemented last year seems to be yielding some positive results. Can you talk a little bit about those programs?
Yeah, so Wit and Wisdom and then 95%. The state has a goal of by 2027, 70% of third graders will be reading on grade level by the time they enter fourth grade and complete third grade. And this last year, we were at 69%. So we are well on our way to surpassing the state goal as well as our own personal goal, which is 90%. We are entering year three of our five-year strategic plan, and our goal is by 2028, 90% of our third graders will be reading on grade level by the time they complete third grade.
Awesome. I think that covers everything. Is there anything else you guys think we should know?
I'll just say tonight, welcome back concert at Canyons Village from 4 to 6. We're grateful for our community partners who are going to have booths set up. It's a free concert, just a way to welcome our community back and celebrate the great work, as well as kick the school year off on a positive note.
Right.
And I just wanted to piggyback about the comments about the training that you had for the administration, that the board also values our learning and development as well. So we had two or three retreats earlier in the year when our new board was seated, and then we have a board retreat coming up at the end of next week. That's a full-day retreat for just the board to do some training, do some goal setting. So we really value that as a board, as well as within the organization of the district as well. And definitely looking forward to the concert tonight, too.
That's a good point as well. I know Susan Goldberg, another board member, mentioned she went to the convocation, and board members are kind of attending different district events, just visiting schools. Do you guys like mandate that, or is that just kind of wanting to be involved?
I think it's just, you know, obviously a couple of us have parents still in school, so there's more opportunities to show up and be at schools than maybe for the board members who don't have kids in school. And I think they can just decide to plug in wherever it feels right for them and their schedule.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Park City School District Superintendent Lindsay Huntsman and Board of Education President Meredith Reed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A popular trailhead at the upper elevations of Park City will close for several weeks due to construction. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more.
The Mid-Mountain Trailhead on Marsac Avenue is closing as contractors begin to work on improvements, according to Icon Construction. The 29-space expanded lot will have a berm to separate it from the road, allowing for a one-way entrance and exit. That way, vehicles don't have to back onto Marsac Avenue. Other improvements include a restroom, a new information kiosk, and parallel parking for vehicles with trailers. A turnaround for Park City buses will also be installed. The project is expected to be completed by October 1st. Hikers and bikers can utilize the free Park City Transit Purple Bus on weekends to reach nearby trailheads, including Bonanza Flat and Bloods Lake. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Joining me in studio is Arts Council of Park City and Summit County Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder and Jacob Crane from Cultural Fire Events. They have some details on Saturday's Art on the Trails. How are you?
Well, thanks. Thanks for having us.
So good. Thank you.
So I'm first wondering if we can do a little recap or overview of what Art on the Trails is.
Absolutely. So this is a signature program that the Arts Council produces. The Arts Council, we are an independent nonprofit, and we're always on a mission to ensure arts and culture thrives in this community. And we piloted Art on the Trails in 2018 as an idea to connect art and nature in a really kind of unexpected and immersive way. When I think about why many of us live here, it is to honor our natural surroundings, and so many of us are motivated to get out on the trails, and it's a big part of our quality of life, but so is arts and culture. It's one of the main reasons why I moved here. And so the intersection of the two is actually, it's a really fun way to program. And so people are invited to attend this event. It is at Copper Moose Farm Stand is kind of our HQ, we'll call it. And that's where people gather. There's parking at Willow Creek Park right across the street. We're super grateful to Copper Moose Farm Stand for their partnership. And we curate a series of performances on a stretch of ADA Trail, which is the McLeod Creek Trail. So many locals might know it. It's very flat. It's very easy, accessible to all, even wheelchairs. So I've actually bumped into people who might bring, someone who might need a wheelchair, which is, it's so exciting to us that people of all ability levels could attend. And it's about an hour and a half experience when you book a trail tour. The event takes place between 2 and we book tours up until 4 p.m. And you walk out on the trail with about 25 other community members, and we have tour guides, and they will talk about the different experiences that you will encounter. It's a really, really lovely way to get out and enjoy nature, but also see some of the amazing performing arts talent that exists in, our Utah community.
Yeah, and so Cultural Fire Events is going to be there. So, Jacob, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what their role is.
Yeah, so Cultural Fire Events, we're a local nonprofit organization out of the great state of Utah, indigenous-led, and we, have since grown, and we, added on a dance performance sector to our organization. So we have a dance group now, and a lot of the folks that come to the Arts Trail are going to see, amazing championship dancers that are Native American. They come from the 8 federally recognized tribes of Utah. So some folks are coming from the Navajo Nation, some folks are coming from the Northwest Spanish Shoshone, and so forth. And so they'll see a variety of dancers, from the hoop dance to the women's scrub dance to the men's chicken prairie dance. So really excited to be a part of this.
I'm curious that you've got a lot of different dancers joining. How do they all get involved with this organization?
Well, some folks I've known for years, but other folks reach out to me and they say, hey, how do I, audition to be a dancer in your dance troupe? And I said, hey, just show up and, give us your number and we'll call you folks and, see how everybody does. But there's so many amazing, talented Native American powwow dancers here in the great state of Utah. So it's really easy to find, talent and book them. And, everyone's always excited to be a part of Cultural Fire Events. We want to make sure that, all of our dancers have a great time.
I've had the privilege of attending a powwow before, and it's just a really lovely experience. And with all the different kinds of dancers, it's really cool to see all these different dances. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some of the differences between those dances, just to kind of give our listeners an idea of what it looks like.
I'll talk about the Prairie Chicken Dance in particular. So that comes from Treaty 7 territory, actually. It comes from where I'm from in Alberta, Canada. And it's kind of just made its way across the plains. And a lot of tribes have adopted that style of dance. And so it's supposed to mimic a prairie chicken. And so the movements are pretty smooth, but also pretty quick. And so, again, those dances are going to differentiate from, you know, the hoop dance, for example. And a lot of folks have fell in love with the hoop dance that are, you know, allies and, you know, Americans. They all know the hoop dance. And you can look it up on Google, but it actually is a healing dance, and it originates from the Taos Pueblo community. And so the individual dancing will make different symbols or animals with their hoops. And so, again, that's going to be very different from the prairie chicken dance.
Right. And I know the dances are an art in themselves, but what the dancers wear is also artistry in itself. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah. So the different regalias, when we say regalia, it's just because, you know, costumes or outfits is kind of more like when you're trying to be somebody that you're not. Yes. And whereas regalia is more of like ceremonial items and clothing that we wear. And so, again, they're all handcrafted. A lot of the beadwork that you'll see either comes from tribal or family designs, or maybe the artist decided that they wanted to create something. And so it represents something a little bit more. And I always say, you know, this is Indigenous athleticism at its finest. We are the OG Zumbas of Turtle Island, aka North America. So again, a great way to stay in shape and to get our community moving in a good way.
Okay, so are on the trails, we'll see some of these beautiful dancers. What kind of other stuff will attendees be seeing?
Yeah, we will be featuring Elizabeth B. Music. This is Elizabeth Jereza. She's a local singer-songwriter, also splits time in Nashville and has done really well there. Super excited to have Elizabeth. Rhythm Nation Tap Company, so you'll see some tap dancing on the trail. We'll have a kind of a stationed band at Copper Moose Farm. So if we do sell out of tickets, tickets are selling out. We have a few left. So head to pcscarts.org to grab your ticket. It's $25 to attend this experience. If you don't grab a ticket, you can always just head to Copper Moose Farm stand. We will have Changing Lanes Band. You know, this is a band that many people know and is such a fun, energetic experience. They'll be at the Copper Moose Farm stand. We'll end the experience with an exclusive performance by Park City Opera. We'll also have Utah Symphony, Utah Opera performers. It's a brass ensemble with Christopher Dance and Jessica Dance. And then we'll also have visual arts on the trail. So we have plein air painters, Alyssa Sabo, Olga Hegner, and Marley Wright. And then we also have a sculpture group, Steel Ranch Welding, from the eastern side of the county that will be showing some sculptures. So it's a really amazing event, and we hope you attend. Again, pcscarts.org. This is this Saturday, August 23rd, 3 to 6 p.m. Tours go from 2 to 4. You sign up for a trail tour slot. So they start at 2. They go to, you know, 2:20, 2:40, 3 o'clock. I believe the 2 and the 4 are sold out. There's a few more that might be sold out. This is a favorite event. So we hope people just come out and support us and immerse in arts and nature at Art in the Trails.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you already mentioned this, but how many years have you been putting this event on?
So this started in 2018. Now, it looked very different then. We didn't do trail tours. It was very passive and organic, and we actually figured out that didn't work very well. So it's changed in its format over the years, and I think we finally found a format that audiences really connect to. So math, what's that? We're in 2025, so 8 years or so. Mm-hmm. And it's been a really beloved event by people, and people come back every year.
Awesome. And I know there are some other events coming up, namely the Monster Drawing Rally on September 13th. at the Kimball Arts Center. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the Monster Drawing Rally, also an annual event that we have hosted in partnership with the Kimball Arts Center for many years, since 2016. And it's technically a fundraiser for both the Arts Council and the Kimball Arts Center. We're in its ninth year. And this is a live art-making event where artists create artwork live in 50-minute increments. And then artwork is donated to back to the nonprofits and sold at live auction for $50. Now, that $50 price point is very intentional. It's very rare to be able to buy original artwork for $50. And so our goal is to make sure that art collecting can feel accessible for people. And also, you know, this is artwork that's created in an hour, right? So it's meant to have, you know, this it's very special because it is original, but it's a really wonderful way for local artists. We have, I think, 28 local artists signed up to participate. And so they're all making artwork live at the same time. So it feels, we call it the Monster Drawing Rally because it does have that kind of big chaotic nature. Fun chaos, I will say. The energy and the vibe of the event is so wonderful, and we've loved putting this on with the Kimball Arts Center for many years. It's held outside, right outside of their studios in the back, kind of where the Boneyard parking lot is. And it's just really a big art party in a parking lot. I can't say enough about it. We'll have a bar. There's also a silent auction. This is a great way to support artists and the organizations, because when you buy a piece of artwork at the silent auction, 60% of that sale goes directly back to the artist. So it's to celebrate nonprofits who work in the visual arts space. Obviously, Kimball Arts Center is kind of the dominating organization that does that work. And as an arts council, right, we want to ensure that arts and culture thrives in Summit County. And part of that is making sure that we're amplifying these arts and culture organizations' missions, right? So we brought this concept to the Kimball back in 2016, and it's been a great fit for all of us. And so we're able to help tell their story as visual art practitioners and a nonprofit that makes great impact in our community, while also platforming local artists and then giving everybody a chance to win this incredible piece of unique art for $50. And what's fun about it is you can't reach deeper into your pockets to win that piece of artwork. It's a whole game. It's luck of the draw. So we actually have a traditional deck of cards, and whoever wants to bid on the piece has to choose a playing card, and ace high wins. And so it's a really playful way to run a live auction. And we've even have like students who bring their allowances and they participate in the auction. It's really, really fun. And so we encourage people to come out for that. This is also a ticketed event as it is a fundraiser. If you go to KimballArtsCenter.org, again, it's September 13th, 3 to 6 p.m., and you can buy tickets online for $25, $10 for kids age 6 to 17, and free for children under 5.
Awesome. And we've also got the gallery stroll next week.
Yes. And this is a monthly event. So I'm always here to shout from the rooftops about our gallery stroll because it's awesome. We are such a unique community where we have a concentration of many, many galleries on our main street. And then also walkable, we have, you know, Prospector Square galleries. We have the Jago Gallery, Create PC, which is the local artist collective that the Arts Council runs, and the Kimball Arts Center. So this is a great way to really immerse in our local gallery scene and also patronize. You know, this is a great time to patronize your local restaurants and make an evening of it through arts and culture. So if you're interested, this is Friday, August 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. And you can go to parkcitygalleryassociation.com for more details. And then that same weekend, we have the Miners 9 Art Show. This is an art show run. It's a very kind of grassroots effort run by local artists. It's spearheaded by local artist Peg Bodell. Many people know her. She's been a longtime arts advocate and art practitioner in the community for years. So this art show is at Miners Hospital. It's free to attend, and it takes place August 29th through 31st. Friday is 12 to 7. Saturday is 10 to 7. And Sunday is 10 to 4. And they every month they do this through the spring and summer. This is the second to last show. So the last show will be in September. So this will be one of the last opportunities to catch this show. And they every month they host 9 artists, hence Miners 9. And so it's an event that's, again, free and open to the public. And you can see photography, jewelry, painting, pottery, woodwork, metal, and more. They don't have a website, but if you have questions, you can always email miners9art@gmail.com, even if you're an artist interested in participating in the September show. But again, this is walkable to Main Street and a really cool building to go see some cool artwork.
Awesome. I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you both so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Arts Council of Park City and Summit County Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder and Jacob Crane from Cultural Fire Events. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.